I want to invite you to turn to the book of Matthew, chapter 5. So my first job in a church was as a youth minister. It was actually as a youth intern. When I was 18, I was still a high school student, actually. I was hired to be a summer intern at a church, a summer youth intern. And the thing about being a youth intern is you're supposed to work for a youth pastor. Like, that's kind of the deal. You intern under somebody. But 2 weeks before my internship at this particular church was supposed to start, the youth pastor at the church quit. So I got there, like, ready to start my internship, and they said, oh, right. So we have no youth pastor, but we're looking for one. So while we're looking for one, why don't you just do that job? And I was like, I was just cleaning out my locker like an hour ago, and now I'm being told, like, oh, you're a youth pastor now. I'm super qualified for that. So this is how desperate some churches are for youth pastor staff. So they told me, like, yeah, so you will work officially. Your boss will be the executive pastor, which her name was Julie. And you just report to Julie. You do all of the work and stuff, and we'll let you know if we hire somebody. And that was how I did my job. And I kind of saw that as like a kind of an exciting opportunity. And everything was pretty good. And then we went to camp. But before the previous youth pastor had left, he had signed up the whole youth group. It was about like 20 kids or so. He had signed them up for camp. And it was down at Mary Hardin Baylor University in Belton. And it was with a bunch of other churches. And so all I had to do basically was like get them down there and make sure everybody like showed up to all the correct events on time and then get them back home. Like, it should be a pretty easy deal. And there were four total sponsors. There was me and there were two college age girls who were about a year older than me. So like totally qualified to be doing all this work. And then there was one mom, and we're going to call her Gail for the purposes of the story. And you'll figure out why that is in a second. But there are the four adults, I'm using the word adult very loosely here, but there were the four adults and about 18 to 20 kids ish. And we, I had an actual head count when we left, but I can't remember what it was. 18 years ago, guys. So we went and everything is going great. I'm actually feeling pretty good about myself. Like, there are other youth ministers there who kind of see me as like this, like, babe in the woods sort of, like, and so they decided to like take me under their wing. And actually I'm still friends with some of these guys to this day, because trauma will do that to you. And everything's going pretty well until the second to last night of camp. And this could be a really long story. There's so much stuff here. I'm going to try and condense it because I could spend the whole half hour just telling you this story. But long story short, we're second to last night of camp. The two college age girls come and find me and they tell me, so I think we may have a problem because Gail, the adult, who, by the way, drove half the kids here in her own personal van, she's been smoking in the dorm. And because, like, first of all, we saw her smoking in the dorm. And second of all, like, she's probably been doing this all week because there's like ashes all over the bathroom sink. So what do we do? And I'm, again, like, I'm 18 and I'm like, I don't know. Like, I have no business telling a grown up not to smoke. Like, what am I, but it is against the rules. Like, I'm a rule follower and I'm definitely responsible for this in some way, apparently. But I don't know what to do. And so I go and I find the guy who's running the camp, a guy named Scott, who's the youth pastor at First Baptist San Antonio. And I ask him, like, what do I do? Like, I have this situation. And he understands, first of all, that this is something that does have to be addressed, but second of all, something that maybe I'm not fully equipped to address. And so he decides he's going to do me the biggest favor ever. And he says, I'll tell you what, I'll talk to her. You come with me. You don't have to say a word, which I'm totally cool with. He says, you don't have to say a word. I'll do all the talking. It'll be easy. And I said, great. You know, lead the way. And so we go and we find Gail, and he's great. He's smooth and diplomatic. And he says, he tells him, like, or he tells her, we got a report that maybe somebody's been smoking in the dorms. And look, whether or not the reports are true, it's my job to make sure we follow up because we signed a contract with the university and we could get kicked out or we could be fined. They could not invite us back next year. And so we just have to make sure everything's on board. And her first response is like, I haven't been smoking. And like, so first of all, not what we were looking for. And he says, great, that's fine. He says, even if you have been smoking, that I'm not judging you. This is what he says. He says, my mom smokes. I'm cool with smoking. Smoking is great. But said the Baptist youth pastor. And And he said, it's fine. We just, because of our agreement with the university, we just need you to go across the street. No big deal. And she said, okay, well, I do smoke, but I haven't been smoking in the dorm. But if I do have to smoke, I will go across the street. Thank you for talking to me. And he says, sure. Thank you for being so patient. And then he says to me, oh, we got to go to a meeting. Why don't we go together? And so we both get up. I have not said a word, not a word. And so we leave and he puts his arm around my shoulder and he looks down at me like he's so proud of us. Like we did a thing together. And he says, I think that went really well. Spoiler alert, it didn't. And so 2 hours later, I'm feeling pretty good. Like I handled a crisis by not doing anything. And the same two college girls who started this whole thing by telling me something I didn't want to know came and found me. And they said, actually, the problem now is much bigger because Gail has left camp. And she packed up all of her stuff. She like her dorm room is bare. Her mattress is like she left her key and like her hall, like her meal pass, like sitting on the bare mattress. Her van is not here. We have been stranded in Belton. and now I'm totally panicked. I don't know what to do. And by the way, her kids were there at camp with us, and she did not take her kids with her when she fled like the campus. So now I've got to like go talk to her kids and tell them, we don't know where your mom is, which is not a thing you ever want to tell a 13-year-old girl, but whatever. So I did. And then I have to call Julie, my boss, and tell her, like, hey, this whole thing happened. And her first response is, what did you do? And I had to tell her, like, I literally did nothing. Like, this, me doing nothing actually seems to have gotten us here in the first place. And like, long story short, we found her. Her husband found her, and he called Julie, and she called me and said, like, okay, she was feeling very embarrassed, and she'll come back on the last day of camp. She'll pick all the kids up, but she's not coming back until camp is over. Oh, like, that's the best we could hope for. And so, and she came back, and I felt so bad. Like, and I went and I found her, and I thought, like, this is such a big misunderstanding. I apologized if we had embarrassed her. I said, like, I didn't know what to do. Like I was just trying to follow the rules. Scott said this is what we should say. And she would not look at me. She would not talk to me. To this day, this person hates me. And it all stems from this moment. And one of the things I've realized, I was 3 weeks into what is now an 18-year long like series of events where lots of people have chosen for one reason or another not to like me. And this was the first one. And one of the early lessons I had to kind of pick up in doing ministry work, and this is one of the hardest lessons that I continue to sort of mentally reject as often as I can, is sometimes people are going to be mad at you, and no matter how hard you try, and no matter how much you don't do, because like a part of it was just like, I don't want to do anything, because like if I do anything, she'll be upset. Well, guess what? I didn't do anything, and she still got upset. And so what I've learned is, yeah, sometimes people are going to get mad, and like I can't do anything about it. And one of the things, again, one of the hard things I've had to learn over, like, again, maybe the hardest thing of this entire work, because a big part of going into ministry work is you want to help people, and you want people to feel good about the help that you're giving them. And when people like walk away hating you, you feel like you kind of failed. And then there have been a series of events, and this was the first of, for one reason or another, people like walking away from a situation feeling really upset with me. And sometimes it's my fault and sometimes it isn't, but the end result is still the same and I hate it. And one of the things that I've tried so hard to do in this work, and I almost always fail, is I want to keep everybody happy all the time because I feel like that's the way it's supposed to go. But that's not real. That's not how it is. And we've been in this series for a while. Today's the last day of our series, but we've been in the series on the invisible patterns that we all sort of adopt. And one of the patterns that we have is driven by the need to keep everybody happy. And the pattern is I am aggressively seeking harmony and agreement and stability and peace of mind. I need people to not be angry with me. I need people not just to not be angry with me, but not to be angry with each other. And this is because it begins as I need peace of mind internally. I need people to be okay with me. But bigger than that, I need people to be okay with everybody else. I need there to be peace around me, like in my orbit. And a person with this pattern, it's funny, like last week we talked about people who are like perfectly comfortable with conflict. And today we're talking about people who would like drive 100 miles out of their way to avoid conflict. Like, and so if you understand this story, if you like get as like anxious as I do just by hearing that story, then yeah, maybe this is part of your internal makeup. Maybe you have this pattern in you. And people who have this pattern tend to, like, to the furthest extreme, tend to struggle a lot with being indecisive. And because any choice negates any other choice. And so by negating somebody else's preference, you are maybe potentially creating conflict. Like, for example, if you are in a group of people and somebody says, let's go to lunch, where do you want to go? Most people have a preference. But a lot of people with this pattern specifically, will never voice their preference. Because what if the choices are Mexican food or barbecue, and you want Mexican food? But if you say Mexican food, and there's somebody else who really wants barbecue, and they go with Mexican food because your voice was the deciding factor, then we'll go eat Mexican food, but then there will be this one person who's mad the whole time because they wanted barbecue. And most of us are like, is this really a thing that people worry about? Yeah, it is. There are people in this world, there are people in this room right now, who like spend a lot of energy not wanting to make a choice because I just don't want to be the reason somebody gets upset, even if it's something this small. And so it's possible that if you have this pattern, it's possible like you don't want to make those kinds of decisions because any decision might inadvertently like cause conflict or like make somebody upset, and you may never know that they got upset. Like weeks from now, they may be sitting there thinking like, man, I really wish we'd gotten barbecue, you know? You never know. And so it's possible that growing up, you lived in a household where there was lots of conflict. And maybe at a certain point you decided, I will be the one person in this house that nobody's mad at. Even though like siblings are yelling at each other, parents are yelling at each other, parents are yelling at siblings, I will be the one person that everybody is fine with. And so you begin to see your role as, I'll be the one kid who never gets yelled at. And I'll be the one kid that everybody is fine with all the time. And so maybe you adopted this pattern very, very early in life as a way of sort of figuring out how to live in your own home. And so this pattern comes from, again, it all is driven by this internal need for everything to be fine, for there to be no conflict, and for everybody to get along. And at best, this person can often be described as a peacemaker, or a natural mediator, or a reconciler. In fact, if you've been listening to this whole series, and every week there's been a part of your brain that's been like, well, that point of view makes a lot of sense. It's possible that this is actually your pattern, because people who have this pattern are really, really good at seeing the world through somebody else's eyes. Because if your whole goal is to create harmony and equilibrium between everybody else, part of that is you need to know what everybody else feels like they need and they want. And so you get really, really good at empathizing and sort of like putting yourself emotionally in somebody else's place. Which is, again, that's a gift. We need more of that. And it's possible that you're great at making people feel understood and validated. It's possible that you are really, really good at being diplomatic. Because you do. You're able to hear somebody's side of an argument, and you are able at some level to say, well, I understand that. That makes sense. Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to find a meeting place between two disparate parties. And so this whole pattern is driven by the need to seek reconciliation and peace in situations where there is conflict. And again, in a healthy situation, this is like this person is a much needed peacemaker or a reconciler. In fact, take a look at what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5. In Matthew 5, verse 9, Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. This is one of the only, like, of all the patterns that we've talked about, this is the only one that Jesus, like, takes a moment to say, like, this person, a person who has this, like, just inside them, they get it. Like, this is the only one that Jesus, like, takes this particular pattern and says, a person who does this, they're really dialed into something that is great. That blessed are people who know how to do this. Like there is a true gift to this whole pattern. Take a look at Romans chapter 12. In Romans 12, this writer Paul says in verse 17, he writes, do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Now, to some people, like, that's a challenge, and to some people, that's a way of life. Like, of course, I spend every waking moment trying to live at peace with everyone. And so Paul is affirming that, and he's saying, yeah, this is, like, if your impulse is to seek common harmony between two people or between yourself and everybody else, there is a part of you, like, you are, that there is a divine spark within you that longs for that. And we need people who have a deep desire to live at peace with everyone. And again, if this is you, it's very likely that you're really good at giving people the benefit of the doubt. It's possible that you are really good at assuming that no matter what a person is doing, they're mostly like probably doing the best that they can. I will, I didn't ask if I could do this. My wife has this pattern. So, this is definitely a part of my wife's internal makeup. And here's why I know why. Because my wife can be very, very angry at somebody. And like a person can do something really, really mean to her. And she can spend about 15 seconds being really mad about it. And then after that 15 seconds say, yeah, but you know, they probably had a really rough week at work. Or like, you know, I don't know what's going on like at home, or you know, maybe they got a phone call that didn't go their way. Like someone could slash her tires and she could be really mad about it and be like, well, you know, they did make an interesting point. And and so like there is this internal like thing inside of a lot of people that is that really very naturally longs to see the world through other people's eyes. And that is, again, it's a gift. It is this is something we absolutely need. And again, if this is you, it's possible that you can see someone doing something that other people would see as destructive or harmful or mean. And at some level inside of you, you can acknowledge that all those things are there, but there's a part of you that says, I wonder what happened to this person that made them this way. You know, and that's, again, that's a gift. A person who has this pattern is able to continue to see the humanity in other people even when they are at their worst. And that is a beautiful gift to have. So one of the things that we've been talking about in the series is we look at the pattern and we've been trying to acknowledge that each of these patterns just is. It's not good or it's not bad, it just is. And so one of the things that we're trying to figure out is how do you be healthy from within this pattern? Because it's possible from this place to be unhealthy. It's also possible to be really healthy. And so the question becomes, okay, how do we channel this in a healthy, positive way and become who we were ultimately created to be? And so what we're gonna do now is first of all, we're gonna look at some of the struggles that people who have this pattern may deal with, not all the time, but sometimes, or in certain situations may deal with. And then we're gonna look at maybe some practices that we can try and embody that may help us move closer to a healthier, positive disposition. So first of all, the first struggle from this place, you might say it results in sort of the loss of self. Or the loss of agency. And what I mean by that is people with this pattern tend to deprioritize their own needs and wants because they're trying to keep everybody else happy. And so I will worry about myself after everybody else is taken care of. And in fact, that can go to the furthest extreme of this is it's possible not even to know your own thoughts or to know your own opinions because you have so deeply internalized those things for other people and that they've sort of consumed, like other people's thoughts and feelings have kind of consumed and eclipsed your own. So it's possible that you can be in a conversation with somebody and like they're making such an impassioned argument or they're saying something with such conviction and there's something inside of you that thinks like, I'm not totally sure I'm on board with this, but by the end of the time that they're talking, if you have this pattern, it's possible that you have sort of absorbed and kind of taken on their point of view, even though like deep inside you know you don't really think that way. And so it's possible that you begin to sort of lose yourself in the name of trying to keep everybody else happy or keep everybody else at peace or to make other people, not to make sure other people agree with you, but to make sure other people believe that you agree with them, if that makes any sense. And so one of the things that this sort of a phrase I've heard a lot is the art of self-differentiation. And what that is, it's sort of the ability to be in a conversation or a situation and to kind of have an intuitive sense of this is where I stop and this is where this other person begins, that I am not this person and this person is not, like we ourselves have not blended together in some sort of weird way, that we are two individual people and that there are things that make me not them. And so a lot of times people who have this pattern need to consciously kind of go into this, okay, where is the water's edge between where I am and where they are in terms of thought or practice or behavior, because it's very easy to kind of lose yourself in, I'm trying to make sure everybody else is happy. And so this is one of the ways that can happen, is sort of the loss of self and the loss of identity. So if this is you, maybe a question becomes, in what ways have I kind of forfeited my own individual self in the name of trying to sort of blend in or maintain equilibrium with other people? So, because it's okay to like be in a relationship with somebody and not see the world the same way that they do. That's fine. So anyway, that's one way. And then the second way is, the second possible kind of path that is potentially harmful would be sort of a pattern of inaction or disengagement. And what I mean by that is it kind of goes back to the restaurant decision, which is like sometimes, and really my going back all the way back to the camp story with me, which is I wanted to do nothing. Like that was my preference in that situation was to like go back to bed and let other people fix this problem and tell this woman to not smoke and or at not smoke at camp. I'm not gonna like be the Surgeon General for anybody, but the. But like I didn't want to do anything. Like my and when Scott offered to like do all the talking, I was like, great, because I don't have anything to say here. I want to say nothing. I want this to not exist at all because this is a conflict I didn't ask for. By the way, the weirdness of being at a massive camp with a bunch of teenagers and college students, and it's the one mom that's smoking in secret in the dorm is insane. But whatever. But it's been 18 years, I'm still not over it. But the pattern of I cannot handle this, I can't get into this because no matter what I do, it will create some sort of conflict because any action might result in future disagreement or future conflict or future discussions that you don't want to be a part of. And so the easiest thing in the world is to basically just like tune out and just kind of like basically like mentally like flip to a different channel and just pretend like nothing's going on at all. And because it's too much, like mentally, it costs too much, it's too expensive, and it weighs too much to actually like fully engage in what's going on around you. And I mean, again, I get this. In moments when I tend to go really into a stressful like season, I feel a lot of anxiety. Specifically, if I feel like people are upset with me or like there's like a conflict that's coming, I am not able to like do my work. What I end up doing a lot is like all of a sudden my office gets really clean and I make a lot of iTunes playlists. You know what I mean? Because that's easier. It's easier to do something that has where the stakes are very low than to actually engage the thing that actually like forces me into a situation that may create some conflict. Or may not even create the conflict, but just sort of acknowledge and engage the conflict that already exists. So when healthy, this kind of person, again, is a peacemaker, is a reconciler. But when unhealthy, this person may often fail to see their own value. Like one of the pitfalls here is to begin to believe that I'm not as valuable or I'm not as important as other people. Because that becomes a thing too. Like if you internalize everybody else's stuff and you don't deal with your own stuff, then like you sort of begin to internally believe that I'm the least important person in the room because I'm acting as if I'm the least important person in the room or I'm internalizing my thought process that way. And so I begin to truly believe that. And that begins to either create sort of a cycle of chronic despair or even repressed anger because there's a certain part of you that rebels against that because it's not true. You're not the least important person in the room. You are equally important. You are just as important as everybody else is. But this, like a repeated cycle of interacting with other people as if their needs, wants, and preferences in this moment are more important than yours every single time, you'll begin to tell yourself a story that you are the least important person in the room. And it's not true. And so that's some of the ways that this tends to sort of go into a place where maybe this is less healthy. And so then the question becomes, all right, well then how do we move towards a place of health? How can you have this pattern and actually become more and more of who God has created you to be? So the first one I would say is, which I feel like we pretty well alluded to a second ago, which is establish and enforce personal boundaries. And what I mean by that is know what you can afford and know what it is that you can offer to somebody without it costing you something. One of the things that I really struggled with when we first started this church was how often to meet with people. Because when we first announced that we were going to start a church, there was a flood of people who wanted to either get, I say like 30 or 40 people who wanted to get coffee or lunch because everybody who was thinking about coming to the church wanted to take some time and figure out like, well, what is this? Because, you know, if you're creating something from nothing, there's a sense of like, I need to know what this is before I like engage in it in any sort of level. So there were a lot of times I would spend a lot of time at either coffee or lunch with people, just kind of asking and answering questions about the church, which is great. That is a thing. I love doing that because I get to know new people. But every once in a while, you'll get somebody who wants your time, and they do not accurately articulate their motives. Let's say so. I developed a policy where I basically said like I will meet with anybody. I'll get coffee or lunch with anybody one time, at least one time. But if that person violates my boundaries in that time, then that's the last time. And so, and specifically, it was if I show up at this thing and this person has a thing to sell me, then I am all done. This will be our last like. like coffee meeting or whatever. And so, and that started because when this whole thing started, I would get emails from people who would say like, hey, I've been listening to your podcast and I really like it. Or like, I want to know about your church. Or, I've been reading your blog. I just wanted to ask you some questions. And so I would go and I would sit down and they would like ask me like one or two questions. Like, oh, hey, you started a church. That's great. Let me ask you something. Do you have dreams? Because I have a thing to sell you that can really help you. And then they want to sell me like motivational tapes or like some sort of like powder that's supposed to, like, if you take it, it helps you sleep at night or something like that. And if that's how you're making money, that's great. I'm not gonna begrudge anybody a living. My thing is, like, do not ask me to go to lunch with you under false pretenses and then expect me to go back to lunch with you again for a follow-up. You know what I'm saying? So I kind of had I decided really early, and my fear was, I started out basically like, I'll go to lunch with as many people as want to, and I will go as often as I am invited. And the day I stopped doing that was the day I realized, like, I just don't have the bandwidth. And because my fear was, if I say no to this person, even though he definitely wants to sell me something, if I say no to this person, he'll get mad. And he like, and then he'll never visit my church. Or he'll like say something about me to somebody else, and then that person will never visit this church. And so I began to sort of tell myself all these like terrible stories about like, isn't it just easier to go and give away an hour of your life, even though you know this person is just gonna like give you a sales pitch about something you're never gonna buy. And like, and he's kind of like exploiting the fact that he's friends with you, like just as a way of like trying to sell more things. And again, if that's how you're making your money, that's great. Just don't lie to me. Just don't invite me to lunch under false pretenses. So I decided really early, like, no, if I get the sense that somebody has an agenda, if somebody wants something from me outside of like what is naturally expected of a pastor in my position, then I just don't have the bandwidth. And so I ended up having to say no to a lot of people, and like those people dropped off the planet. And like, I don't, like, some of them may have been mad at me, some of them may not have been. It's just I had to kind of come to a moment of, I only have so many days in my life, and I cannot listen to that many marketing pitches. I just don't have it. I just don't have it in me. And so I had, because what if there's somebody who really does need to get lunch because they actually have a legitimate thing that they need to discuss, but I already said yes to this guy who like has, you know, like, I don't know, some sort of extra powerful like juice blend that's gonna change my life or something. And so again, no shade to anybody who sells things. I'm just saying, like, I'm not buying. But but all of this is, it's you have to know, like, where does the water stop? Or where is the water's edge for, like, what you have time for, what you have energy for? Because, again, this pattern says, yeah, but isn't it easier just to go and just, like, kind of bite the bullet and deal with somebody wasting your time just so that they're not mad at you later? And the answer is maybe sometimes, but probably not. Because quite often, if it costs you more than you have, like, what are you losing? What is it costing you to go do this? And it's not just like, yeah, I'm gonna spend an hour listening to something that I didn't need and didn't want and will never buy, but, you know, at least this person's not mad at me. Yeah, but what are you not doing that you could have been doing instead? You know what I mean? And so the question, and maybe the answer is, I could have been like just sleeping. Like, that I could have been relaxing. I could have been like living my life in any sort of way. And so the question for this pattern is, are you trying to keep everybody happy all the time? And are you giving massive parts of yourself in the name of making sure nobody's mad at you? Because you can't do it. I have 18 years of experience in this. People are gonna get mad regardless. And there will be times that it's your fault, and when it is your fault, do your best to make it better. But sometimes people are just gonna have expectations that are unreasonable, and you have to understand, like, that's part of it, you know? And so you can't solve everybody's problems, and you can't make everybody happy all the time. Look at Proverbs 26:11. This is one of my, I use this passage probably way too often. I just really like it. But Proverbs 26:11 says this. It says, as a dog returns to its vomit, so fools repeat their folly. This is one of those verses I'm just like, I dare you to write this in somebody's graduation card and see if they notice. Because, you know, Bible verses, whatever. But as a dog returns to his vomit, so a fool repeats his folly. What this writer is saying is, like, look, some people will engage in a cycle of self-destructive behavior. Some people are going to be toxic. Some people are going to do things that are harmful. And every time you enter into that with them, it hurts you all over again. But there's a part of us that feels like we owe it to them, or we don't want to make them mad by not re-engaging at that level, at some level. And what this writer is saying is, you don't have to be there. Like, the dog is going to return to his vomit. The fool is going to repeat his folly. You don't have to be there to enable it every single time. You don't have to be somebody's enabler. You do not owe somebody else your whole self. It is great if you want to help people. It is that you want to help people. I think we are expected to help people. But there comes a point where you have, it's the art of self-differentiation. There comes a point where we have to say, I don't have any more of myself to give. There comes a point where we have to say, I don't have the time. I don't have the energy. I don't have, I don't have it. And so I'm sorry. I wish you well. I hope things are okay. But I cannot go back into this with you again. I cannot continue having the same conversation over and over and over again. I cannot keep getting back on this treadmill with you. And part of it is like just knowing like what are your boundaries? Where do you not have time to give? Because nobody else is going to be more interested in protecting your boundaries than you are. So that's the first thing. And for those of you who have like this, I need to keep everybody happy all the time pattern, for those of you who are natural peacemakers, you are allowed to protect your time. You are allowed to protect your sanity and to protect yourself in whatever way is necessary to keep you healthy. So the next practice I would say is refuse to disengage when you are needed. And what I mean by that is sometimes peacemaking is not just avoiding conflict. Sometimes peacemaking is engaging the reality that conflict exists. And so now we have to try and figure out like where does the conflict exist and how can we become better as a result of it. So I used to work for a pastor, like one of the nicest guys I've ever met, super nice guy. The problem though was this guy absolutely has this pattern and he hates conflict, like deathly afraid. He will drive 100 miles out of his way to avoid an awkward conversation. And so over time, after working for this guy for a while, I began to realize that this is someone who will do anything to avoid any amount of conflict whatsoever. And I realized that because I would go into his office to articulate, like, as this is when I was a youth pastor, to tell him, like, we have this problem. Like, we have a problem with a parent. We have a problem with a kid. We have a problem, like, there's a systemic issue that we kind of need to deal with before it gets out of hand. And he would always, like, every time he would listen so intently. And he would lean in and he would say, oh, yeah. Yeah, I really hear you. I hear that, like a lot of like moaning, like in agreement, and that's really we should definitely do something about that. Okay, yeah. Well, thank you so much for telling me. And then I would leave, and like a month later, the problem is worse, and nothing has happened. And then I'll go back into his office, and I say, I feel like maybe I didn't tell you exactly like why this is a problem and why this person needs to be talked to or whatever. And he would say, oh, yeah, tell me more. And so like I would tell him more, and I hear you. His favorite thing to say was, I hear you. And then and then I would leave, and then nothing would happen. And this, and after I left that church, I would talk to other people who had also worked for this guy, and they were like, yeah, like that was this guy's absolute pattern. And at the time, it was very frustrating to me. But now I look back, and I realize, like, oh, I get it now. Because he understood. He had a crippling fear of conflict of any kind. And he realized that to in any way engage somebody's like real like problems was to like enter into a situation where more conflict was waiting for him. And so it was, I believe he was empathetic. Like while I was in his office, he totally did hear me and he totally was empathetic to what I was saying. But when it came time to actually do something about it, it was like he was like paralyzed by it. And now, like as a senior pastor, I'm way more like sympathetic to what he was kind of wrestling with, because I know the feeling of like I really don't want to make that phone call and I really don't want to have that conversation. But the problem is sometimes we need to, because to avoid conflict isn't the same thing as repairing conflict. Is like keeping the peace is not the same thing as making peace. And that is a hard thing that we have to learn. And so it's easy to disengage. And I think one of the practices is to understand that we actually have a role to play in, like, to be a peacemaker is to actually engage, like, what is my part here? How do I play a part and actually bring some peace into this situation? Even though it's hard, even though it's scary, I have responsibility here. And that's hard. It is a really hard thing to do. Look what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 10. In Matthew 10, Jesus said, this, by the way, I could and have preached a whole sermon about this. There's so much going on in this passage that we don't have time to talk about, but we need to address it here. And so in Matthew chapter 10, verse 34, Jesus says, do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword, which is confusing because several other places in the Bible, Jesus says, I have come to bring peace to the earth. So now we're like, does he know that he said another thing before, or is this something else? And so in verse 35, he says, it actually gets worse. He says, for I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, a man's enemies will be the members of his own household. To which, if, for anybody with like the peacemaker pattern, we're like having like a panic attack. Like, why am I following this guy if this is what this whole thing is leading to? And so in verse 37, it says, anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves their son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up their cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds their life will lose it. And whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. So what is Jesus saying here? Okay, first of all, I have to say in no uncertain terms, Jesus is not advocating or promoting violence. In no way is that what Jesus is saying. And the reason we know that is because that would be inconsistent with every other thing that Jesus has ever said. And so clearly this is about something else. So Jesus is not saying, I'm here to mess up your family. That is not Jesus' end goal, even though that's literally what it sounds like he's saying. Jesus is actually, he's quoting a passage from much earlier from the Old Testament that is a reaction to a situation that was going on a long time before this, in which people were in the middle of basically an ethical crisis, where you would have certain people who were kind of having like a moral awakening and realizing like, oh, we've actually been doing some things that are very destructive, but you have other people who are very resistant to that. And so now you have people who are sometimes in the same families, and some people are saying like, we need to get better at this, and some people are saying, no, we don't. And now you have a situation because there is like some people are kind of awake for the first time, and some people are not interested in waking up because that's challenging. You have people who are saying like, I don't want to go there with you. And so all of a sudden you have people who are part of the same family or the same tribe who are naturally at odds with each other because now you have ideologically a divergent point. And so now people who live in the same house don't know how to talk to each other, which is a totally foreign concept to us today. So we, some of you have talked to your parents this week. So, And so what Jesus is saying here is following my teachings might be hard for some of us who grew up in a system that is at odds with these teachings, and that's not going to be easy if you want to avoid if your whole goal is to avoid conflict, then following a way of teaching that actually really looks into like how do we treat people. If you are in the business, or if you are in the habit of treating certain types of people as if they are less than you, and all of a sudden this guy comes along and he says, actually, we should be, the meek shall inherit the earth, and we should treat the poor as if they were rich. And like, there's all these sorts of things that Jesus begins to say. And if you're if you are very comfortable in your situation where you live in a hierarchy and you are just fine with like everybody who's underneath you continuing to be underneath you, and all of a sudden Jesus comes along and he says, actually, that group of people has dignity too, and we need to treat them like that. All of a sudden, that is a very confrontational thing to say. And you have, because you have some people who are listening and some people who aren't, all of a sudden, there is division in your tribe. For example, have you ever been in a room with people that maybe you are related to, and someone said something that was overtly racist? And now you have a moment where you have to make a choice. And you are in a situation now where you have to say, either you can say nothing, or you have to say, you know, not to be rude, but maybe you want to think of a different way of saying that, or maybe don't say that at all. And so all of a sudden, there is tension inside a family. And so sometimes, for those of us who all we want is agreement and peace, sometimes we have to enter, because we are trying to be reconcilers, sometimes we have to engage a reality of, yeah, but to follow the way of Jesus, sometimes there has to be a little bit of conflict before there can be real reconciliation. And that's hard. And that's very, like, sometimes just the very idea of following Jesus in this way, and like to treat people in the way that Jesus calls us to treat people, can create problems. And like, in fact, just the very existence of this church, I will say, our whole thing, like, we're trying to bring more peace into the world. We have the word peace is on like the wall back there, and yet the very existence of the church has created like some conflict for people, because we for a number of reasons, one of which being like we will regularly, and like as part of our DNA, we seek to empower women in leadership. We have women who preach here, and there are some churches within walking distance of this church that really don't like that. And so the question becomes, yeah, but do we not do that because we just want to keep everybody happy? Or does true peace and reconciliation mean, no, we have to do that in spite of the fact that some people aren't going to like it? One of the things that we've really tried to do at this church is create a safe and welcoming place for our LGBTQ brothers and sisters. And that is something I believe deeply in. And there have been people who have articulated to me in no uncertain terms that that is not something that they're okay with. And so the question I've had to ask myself is, yeah, but am I willing to let that person be mad at me in the name of creating space to offer grace and peace to people who maybe it's been a while since anybody offered them grace and peace? So sometimes we have to enter into conflict in order to make peace. And that is difficult and it's terrifying and I hate it. But it is, this is what Jesus, so when Jesus says, I come to bring the sword, what he's saying is, I'm coming to challenge some assumptions. And some people will go there with me and some people won't. And it's gonna be really difficult. And maybe you've been in a situation where you've had to speak out on behalf of refugees and the poor. In fact, I wish I'd done more research on this, but just like a couple of days ago, I saw a news story where there were like nuns being handcuffed in front of like the state capitol building or some other federal building because they were protesting on behalf of refugees. Like if you're putting handcuffs on a nun, there needs to be a moment somewhere inside you that's like, what's this gonna feel like later? Like how am I gonna, what's that gonna look like in photos? So, but sometimes we're put in a situation because we follow Jesus, we're put in a situation where we have to enter into conflict because we are seeking peace, because we are seeking reconciliation. So all that to say, the practice of, if this is your pattern, if this is your impulse, don't back down. Do not avoid conflict if going into the conflict means that's what looking for peace means. So that's the next practice. And then finally, I want to invite you to embrace and choose the reality that you do matter, that you do have value. Again, if you have this pattern, it's possible that you have begun to sort of buy into the lie that you have less value than other people do. And please do not believe that lie. You matter. You have value. Your sanity, your well-being, your value as a human being matters. You have value. You are loved. And I know it's hard to believe that when you're trying to keep everybody else happy, but you matter too. So we're going to take communion in a second. And maybe as you take the body broken and the blood poured out, maybe the thing that you need to internalize is I am receiving this because this is offered to me, because I am loved. This is the body broken for me. This is the blood poured out for me. And maybe if you've spent a lot of your energy and time believing that you matter less, may you hear the words, this is the body broken for you, the blood poured out for you. So thank you for being peacemakers. Thank you for looking for reconciliation wherever you can find it. And may you reclaim your sanity and yourself. May you believe that you are loved. And to all of us, as we wrap up this whole series, may you become more of who God has created you to be. May you find that you are on a journey of discovering more about yourself because this is who God made you. And so then you can become more and more of who you were always meant to be. May you know that you are loved as well. So let me pray for us. God, we thank you for this time and this place. We thank you for those of us in the room who have this natural gift of seeking out peace and reconciliation. For those who, for those of us who have believed the lie that we lack value, that our function in the world is simply to keep everybody else happy, set us free from that and help us to believe that we are loved and that we are seen. And that when we receive communion, we receive something that is for us from you. And for those of us who are struggling, who are looking for reconciliation, and there's a lot of conflict, give us a sense of peace. Give us a sense of calm. Help us to engage conflict when it needs to be engaged. Help us to be wise. Help us to be peacemakers. Help us to be reconcilers. Help us to be more and more of who you have created us to be. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.